Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Friday edition of the Crossover NBA podcast. I am not Howard Beck, who usually handles the Friday version of this pod. He is beginning a well-earned vacation, or at least a vacation. He'll be off the next couple of weeks. That's right. I take digs at Howard even when he's not around. And I'm here to fill in for you. And I want to do what we're going to do a couple things on this podcast. We're going to talk NBA Summer League because that's just in our rearview mirror. We're also going to talk about the team that never ceases to be boring. The Los Angeles Lakers, who continue to be one of the more dramatic teams in sports history, especially so this summer. To do that, I want to bring in my friend Kyle Goon. Does a great job covering the Lakers for the Southern California News Group. Kyle, what's up, man? Happy July, fresh from Summer League.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, you are obviously very close to the Celtics and know them very well, where a lot of the drama is going on the court and where most NBA reporters are getting time off and kind of unplugging. I get to cover the July drama off the court and hold on to see what the heck is going on with this team, which is, I would love to see some drama on the court, Chris. I really would. And I think some of the principles that we're going to talk about would too.
Yeah, it's a lot to dive into. Howard and I touched on this a little bit on Wednesday's pod, but I want to get your take on a few things. You were in Vegas when there was the non-meeting between LeBron James and Russell Westbrook, both at the Thomas and Mack Center for a Lakers Summer League game. LeBron talked to just about everybody involved or around the Lakers on that night. He did not talk to Russell Westbrook. You wrote about this in the aftermath. How big a deal was that to you? I mean, how significant, how much should we read into the non-discussion between LeBron and Westbrook?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a little subjective, but I read into it a lot because you know, these guys are very conscious about what they do, and especially somebody like LeBron. And I just thought it was telling that, and I don't want to cast blame on Russ. I want to be careful not to cast blame because, oh, who snubbed who? Neither of them went to the other. But it was very telling that, okay, Rob Pelinka's coming over here. Darvin Ham's coming over here. And by here, I mean the baseline where LeBron was sitting. He kind of stayed in one place the whole time. But everybody came over to him, and that kind of makes sense in the sense of he's the franchise player, he's the biggest star, et cetera, et cetera. And it seemed pretty clear that Russ was not going to follow that dynamic. And it also seemed clear that LeBron was not going to go out of his way to go say, hey to Russ. So, you know, if you look back even one summer league, Russ gets traded to the Lakers. He and LeBron are kind of palling around and they're close. I mean, they're friends, or at least were friends, close friends prior to this year. And it just seems really telling that neither one of them wants to make the 94-foot journey to go to the other and just say, hey, like, I mean, these guys are going to see each other in 2 months. They're going to be teammates, theoretically, in 2 months. You can't say hello. And I know some people had different reads on that, but I read heavily into that. And what exactly that means, I'm a little less clear on, but it certainly, it felt very frosty and it felt very deliberate. I thought at some point they were going to at least, you know, if no matter what the state of their relationship was, I thought they were going to kind of go in for, you know, a hug, handshake type thing at halftime. It never happened. Russ left at halftime. It never happened.
Yeah, we've come a long way from the Instagram posts last summer where, you know, LeBron was working out with Russ and LeBron was tweeting out or posting that, you know, count us out at your own peril. We're going to remember everything everybody's saying about us and all that. You know, LeBron, as you well know, pushed for the Russell Westbrook trade. He believed that Russell Westbrook was the right fit for that team. And, you know, a year later, here we are. I mean, when you were at that team every day, yeah, how did that relationship evolve over the course of a year? And what were kind of some of the telling moments that it was changing during or after the season?
Yeah, I mean, I was put on alert from day one of the season. And it was just weird because, you know, they had their big opening night. Russ is coming back to Staples Center for the first time as a Laker. It's exciting. It's like he's talking about, you know, how's that going to feel? LeBron's like, I'm so excited to see him, you know, play for his hometown fans. And it was a big dud. I mean, they came out and Russ, I think, had something like 5 points. And it was sort of a precursor of a lot of games he would go on to have that season. And, you know, Russ was sort of like, oh, you know, first game. Or no. Actually, he was kind of upset. And up to that point, the preseason games, the Lakers went 0-6 in the preseason and everyone had dismissed it. And then Russ had this very short sort of body language about the whole thing because he knew he hadn't performed well. And then both LeBron and AD were like, oh, well, you know, just gotta let him bounce back. But it just seemed so like everyone was so tense because of that moment. And I was like, this is the first game. This it got 81 more games. And everyone's talking like, you know, Russ is like in a severe state of grief and needs severe, you know, just extreme emotional support after one bad game. That just kind of turned my brain on to there's a weird dynamic here. And I think LeBron and AD at that time both seemed to understand that Russ was a little, I want to be careful my wording here. The word I want to use is fragile, but maybe just temperamental is a better word. Mm. And then over time, I mean, the body language evolved. And I mean, it's pretty famous that LeBron gets bad body language when things aren't going his way or the team isn't performing how he wants. And that just kind of kept going. And the body language between Russ and LeBron, when the other had a good game and one didn't, it just seemed, I'll say off. It just seemed like those two never were often on the same page after games and sort of had a little bit of oil and water to them by the end of the season. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, and at the end of the season, I thought it was pretty telling that, you know, LeBron, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, was asked by you guys out there about Russ coming back, and he kind of punted on it. Like, he didn't say unequivocally, like, we want this guy back, we can win with him. They all kind of did the obligatory, we didn't play enough games together, though that, among their problems, that wasn't the top one, you know, as far as why that team didn't succeed. But he had a chance. He had a chance to, you know, unequivocally say, we can win with this guy, bring him back, all that, and he didn't do it. Did you read anything into that? Like, was that something that, like, raised a flag in your head, or did you kind of see that sort of response coming?
Yeah, and the only one of the principals that really did that was Anthony Davis, who said, yeah, you know, we didn't get enough. I still think we can compete with Russ. Like, you know, we only got 21 games, etc. And AD has this sunny point of view, I think, that you get used to as you cover him. He sort of has this reigning sense of optimism. But LeBron said, I love being a teammate of Russ, but said, you know, oh, well, you know, Russ is going to have to decide if he wants to come back or something along those lines. But very kick the can down the road. Rob Pelinka kicked the
as
can
if,
down the
as
road.
If Kyle, as if like Russ had a decision to make about his player option. Like, oh boy, I don't really consider that $47 million player option.
Both LeBron and Rob Pelinka were like, oh, well, you know, Russ has to decide whether he wants $47 million extra dollars or not. And of course, that seems really weird. And they ended up adapting that strategy. But Russ, I mean, most of all, that exit interview kind of kicked dirt on Frank Vogel, said he never, you know, liked me. I don't know why that was. I bought a bottle of champagne for him, but I always had to prove myself to him.
Oh, God, that story was wild. That bottle of champagne story was wild. But and like you, Kyle, know, and most people listen to this podcast or read my stuff know, it's like I'm a Vogel defender. I think he's a good coach. I've known him a long time. You know, like the guy that didn't believe in you played you and started you for 81 games during the season, played you 30 something minutes of games and only benched you a handful of times. Like, and should have benched you more.
Against organizational current. And that's the thing that really Russ had no, if he knew that, he didn't acknowledge it. Like Frank Vogel stuck up for him when a lot of other people didn't want him to play the starting role anymore. Mm-hmm. And when Frank Vogel benched him for the first time, they essentially got the thumbs ups. Like, you know what? If you need to bring him off the bench, you got to bring him off the bench. But Frank thought, if we do that, we lose him forever. And he might have been right, too. I mean, I think he was. I think what we're experiencing now with, you know, Russ, you know, parting ways with his agent, Thad Fouché, is at the very least related to what we're talking about. What kind of role is he going to have on next year's Lakers if he comes back? And is he happy with that? And I think we're seeing perhaps some of the predictive power of Frank Vogel. If we don't start this guy, then we're going to lose him, but they might lose him anyway.
So you mentioned the parting with Thad Fouché. And it happened in a very public way. Thad released a long statement to ESPN, the kind of statement that you almost never see from an agent. Like, you don't see that kind of statement. Like, it was almost like, and this is how I interpreted it, like Thad was trying to get a message to Russ through the media. Like, just whatever he was saying to Russ behind the scenes wasn't getting through to him. Maybe if he read it on ESPN and saw the talking heads on the network talking about it, maybe that would resonate with him. But he's clearly telling Russ, your best option for having a longer NBA career is to stay with the Lakers, where presumably, at least if Darvin Ham's being truthful, you're going to get a chance to start. And you're going to get a chance to win if AD and LeBron are healthy. And you're not going to become a minimum guy, because that's what you would be if you get traded and ultimately bought out. Hell, Howard and I talk about this a lot, Kyle. Like, there's a chance if Russ gets bought out, he's out of the league like next year. Like, I don't, things change on a dime, but like the usual suspects that might sign Russ, you know, New York, obviously at the top of that list, you know, the Dallas, I don't think they would do it at this point. I mean, Charlotte, nah, they wouldn't want him. Like, that, there's not a lot of options out there for him. So I get what Thad Fouché was saying when he said, you know, let's make this work with the Lakers. But how did you interpret that split and the public way which with Thad Fouché announced it?
Yeah, well, first I thought it was an extremely damaging statement to Russ and the Lakers, whether Thad meant it that way or not. I thought it undermined sort of the public posture that the Lakers have had. That's like, hey, you know, Darvin Ham has said in many times in many ways, I can't wait to coach Russ. I think he's going to be great for us. I think he has a lot left in the tank, and he's pushing that message. And behind closed doors, Russ is telling the Lakers, yeah, I'm ready to do everything I said I would do last year, but I didn't do. Although I don't know if he's made that realization that he didn't do those things last year. But Yeah, I agree with you in the sense of what is the wake up call going to be? Because we've seen this kind of thing before where it can feel like you're on top of the league. And I'm sure even as recently as Washington, Russ was behind that push to get the Wizards in the playoffs. They didn't win anything once they got there. But I think he feels like he's that player who's like, I'm a leader of a team that can do things that people don't expect. I think it really matters to him to average a triple double. I think we're past that point where that's just speculation. I think it really matters to him to have the statistical output, and he just can't. I think he struggles anyway to get to that place mentally, to actually understand what it takes, the role he's going to have to play, and however limiting that may feel to be on a winning team. Because he's only advanced past the first round of the playoffs one time since KD left him. One time. And I think, like, LeBron sees that and is like, that's not good enough for what I want to achieve. But I don't know if Russ balances his desire for the role that he thinks he should play with trying to be a winning team. I think he believes, if somebody would just let me play the way I would play, everything would happen. But reality has demonstrated that's not true. So I don't know. I think maybe Thad is trying to break through to him in this very, I mean, damaging, but definitely an attention-grabbing way.
No question, it was attention-grabbing. The last twist to this was the story that Chris Haynes wrote over at Yahoo, where he reported that LeBron, Russ, and AD had a phone call, and they kind of sorted through some things on that phone call. Now, to me, Kyle, that felt a lot like damage control. Like, it was more like, you know, no, it's okay. We're going to be all right going into the season if this is the team that we bring back into the season. Now, LeBron is famous for powwows when it's needed. I mean, I go back to Kevin Love when he struggled with LeBron in that first year. They all sat down poolside in Miami or wherever the hell they were, and sorted it all out. And Kevin Love went on to have a very productive time opposite LeBron in Cleveland. I don't think this was that. You know, I don't even know what was said on this call, but it just felt to me like a bit of damage control on the part of somebody in these camps to try to reassure the Lakers, reassure the NBA that this team was not, you know, past the point of no return. That's how kind of I read. How did you read that story?
Yeah, and first of all, Chris Haynes, very good at his job.
Absolutely,
But the thing that stuck out to me was there's a phone call on the first weekend of Vegas Summer League between the Big Three. And I'm like, all right, well, we got to acknowledge that two of the Big Three were in the same room. Like, and they had to talk on the phone. Like, that's not good, right? I mean, if Russ and LeBron had met in person in Vegas, like, we don't think that would have been part of the report. Like, to me, that's glaring. And not only that, but we're talking about, you know, at this point, a week and a half ago, when they have this phone call, this, all right, are we all on the same page phone call? Well, guess what? Like, Russ has parted ways with Thad since then. And LeBron did something which I interpreted as at best careless, which is he quote tweets his own agent, Rich Paul, and seems to kind of dance on the grave of that partnership. And when, you know, as we've mentioned, Russ is kind of getting publicly undermined by his own former agent, his agent of 14 years, Rich Paul tweets about how it's a cold game, and LeBron piles on Twitter. And again, like, I'm not saying, you know, LeBron is some master chess player who is like has the perfect intention for every move he makes, but you can interpret that he has an intention, right? He has an intention for things he does, and he knows his tweets get read into, and there's subtext for it, and he kind of him allowing that perception to kind of spread out was wild to me about his own teammate, about somebody who's not in a great position, was not going through a great split with his agent, and LeBron allows one of his tweets to be perceived as, is this a shot against Russ? I mean, I went to the Drew League the next day, and talked to, you know, at least five or six different people who have followed LeBron for a long time or know LeBron. Like, what was that about? You know, I mean, I just thought that was crazy for two guys who theoretically, and I mean, perhaps the sun is setting, perhaps LeBron feels it, but theoretically, these guys are going to be teammates in 2 months. So what was that about?
Yeah. So what's your read on what the Lakers want to do in this situation? You don't have to be deeply embedded in the NBA to know the Lakers would love to get Kyrie Irving on the roster. How that happens is complicated because we don't know exactly how the Nets want to play this. We don't know if the Nets want to come to some kind of resolution with Kevin Durant before they do anything. And we don't know exactly what pound of flesh the Nets want to extract from the Lakers in order to make a Westbrook-centric, Kyrie-centric swap. Maybe it includes a third team. Who knows? But those would be the principles in a deal like that. What's your sense of what the Lakers hope happens in the next couple of months?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think that they would want to make it happen. I think what is complex about the Lakers situation is I wonder if ownership in the front office and LeBron's camp, and LeBron obviously is more influential than the average player, I wonder if they're seeing eye to eye on it. And I think it's pretty evident that LeBron and his camp think trading out somehow Russ for Kyrie Irving gets you closer to what a championship team should look like, gives you more of a window than Russ does currently. I also think it's incredibly important to look at privately, you know, the Lakers basically since the trade deadline have been very protective of their first round picks. And then even publicly, Jeannie Buss says to NBA.com last week, oh, well, we don't want to do a deal that further hampers our future. And I think she's starting to get a sense of, and perhaps the front office by extension, it's like, well, what comes next after LeBron? LeBron's going to turn 38 in December. Realistically, if we burn it all now and we don't get there, what happens through 2027 or 2029, which is the two first round picks they can still deal? So I think there's a little bit of, let's say, misalignment there, where LeBron has short-term interest. It's like, we think we can win now with me, AD, and Kyrie. And the Lakers are sort of looking at the long-term interest of the franchise. And I think that is one thing that's complicating the deal. And I also think, you know, I came away from Summer League kind of just hearing a little bit more about the Nets side of things, just less convinced that the Lakers had what they needed to swing the deal. And if you look at various permutations, and what I've heard on the Lakers side is like, okay, well, what if we were to deal Russ and Talen Horton-Tucker for, you know, Kyrie and Joe Harris, and Joe Harris is just finishing a year where he was basically not playing at all. I still think that the Lakers get back the two best players in the deal, if that's yep. who they're looking for. So is the...
Well, Kyle, you know that inside, like, Southern California, Talen Horton-Tucker is Michael Jordan. Like, he's the greatest player, greatest prospect ever. Outside, amongst NBA executives I've talked to, it's like he's a nice prospect who took a bit of a step back last year from the guy we saw a year ago. So, like, I mean, we kind of joked all year long on this pod and elsewhere about, like, the Talen Horton-Tucker, Kendrick Nunn kind of platter the Lakers were offering out there, like it was going to get you Zach LaVine or whatever you're going to like.
And the other part that the Lakers understand internally is, like, coaches knew at the time last year that, like, Talen and Russ couldn't play together. So you're going to package those two dudes. And not that, like, Russ is going to play wherever you deal him, but, like, two guys who are, like, ball handlers who don't shoot very well. It's like, and that's our package. And plus first round picks that matriculate a long time down the line. So for the Nets, where they are with their luxury tax situation, I'm sort of skeptical that's a package that is so appealing that they have to really look at it. But, you know, on the Lakers side, I think their thought was, you know, well, Joe Harris hasn't played, so, you know, what's his value? Are we really going to send Talen Horton-Tucker to the Nets for a guy like Joe Harris with Kyrie? But I think obviously, like, if you look at what the results were last year, obviously the answer would be yes. So I don't know. I mean, I think probably more discussion has to happen on that point, and maybe there's more recent discussions that I haven't heard about yet, but I always thought that was a little strange perspective.
Look, just my opinion, I would go and get Joe Harris. Like, for starters, yeah, he was injured last year. Presumably, he's going to be past that, had the ankle surgery, all that. Previous 2 years, he played 69 games each of those previous 2 years. He is, you know, statistically, the best shooter in the NBA. And, like, what shooter has ever not thrived opposite LeBron James? Like, Kyle Korver played probably 3 years longer than he should have, in large part because of LeBron James. Like, these guys that can shoot, they are the perfect fit. And you put Joe Harris alongside LeBron and Anthony Davis, and you are dangerous offensively, man. You are dangerous.
The other thing that isn't being talked about in this context is the Lakers don't have shooting right now. I mean, their star free agents are all guys who are younger. They may have had a good shooting year in the past, but, like, Lonnie Walker is their mid-level exception guy, and he, like, shot like 31% last year.
And I loved his press conference where he said something along the lines of, like, I know I didn't shoot three well last year, but you leave me open this year and I'm going to make those shots. Like, I'm going to make them. So, all right.
But it's all speculative, right? It's all like, right. We think
he was a 31.4% three-point shooter last year. That was down from the previous 2 years, but you are what your numbers say you are.
So the Lakers need shooting like anything. And last year, that was a key reason why they didn't get where they wanted to get. And they remake their roster, and it's younger and it's faster and maybe defends better, but it still doesn't have shooters, because shooting is such a premium talent that it's very expensive to get. So the Lakers didn't have a lot of salary options to give guys who can actually shoot. So they still have to trade to find that, really. I mean, they have to trade. Even if this Kyrie deal doesn't work out, they're going to have to make a trade to find at least one guy who is proven. And that's a minimum in my mind. Like, I mean, I think you can't go into next season without one shooter who is proven. And they really don't have that right now.
All right, last thing for you. LeBron can be a free agent, or will be a free agent, at the end of next season. On August 4th, he's eligible to sign a contract extension. How much do you think that looms over the rest of the Lakers offseason?
Oh, huge. Huge. And, you know, it's really hard to know at this point where that lies. I mean, I think, you know, at one point it seemed pretty clear that LeBron was definitely going to re-sign here, finish a career here, retire a Laker. You know, there's some big things coming up. You know, he's going to be the all-time leading scorer in regular season history, and that's going to be meaningful to have him in a Laker uniform when he passes Kareem, another Laker. I think there's good things that the Lakers would want to come out of that, but LeBron kind of laid the tracks that maybe he could leave. I mean, he's talked about it, and he tried to pull back on it, but All-Star break this year, he's like, oh, yeah, I'll go to whichever team has Bronny. And then he tried to roll it back by saying that could be the Lakers, but that's not what he said at first. Like, so I think you're seeing signs that the alignment is not where it needs to be. And I know for a fact that LeBron's camp was very disappointed that the Lakers didn't make a move at last year's trade deadline. And that was a huge source of contention. So then right after that is All-Star break. That's when LeBron is complimenting every GM that's not named Rob Pelinka and doing all this stuff. And so I think it's definitely possible that he still holds it over them. I think maybe the best thing for all involved is to figure out at least, you know, two more years where he can be a Laker until he's 40, and then maybe, you know, allow him to figure out what he's going to do with Bronny whenever Bronny comes in the league. But it's definitely less of a sure thing than it was, you know, 7 months ago. And I don't think that's been resolved because this Russell Westbrook situation still isn't resolved. And I think one has a lot to do with the other. I'm not saying that will be for sure the reason that LeBron does extend or doesn't extend, but I think if they make a deal with Russ and if they figure out Kyrie, I think that will go a long way to making sure that LeBron does have a long-term future with the Lakers.
I agree with that. And look, LeBron clearly went to Los Angeles for reasons that are beyond basketball, for a lifestyle, for his burgeoning entertainment company, for the first time, for things that weren't always connected to team success on the court. I get that. But if this team goes through a season similar to what they went through last season, and the Cleveland Cavaliers are still sitting out there as a successful team in the Eastern Conference with quality young players, Evan Mobley, Darius Garland, a whole bunch, Jared Allen, like a whole bunch of young guys, and they wind up in like the fourth or fifth seed in the Eastern Conference with cap space. I think they're owed, they have like $90 million under contract next year because Kevin Love comes off the books, Caris LeVert comes off the books. Kyle, you are going to spend an entire season hearing that stuff. It's going to happen. Like every win the Cavs get versus every loss the Lakers get are going to be contrasted. Like it will be like, look what Cleveland's doing. Look what the Lakers are doing. Look, Cleveland's in town. The Lakers are in Cleveland. And you know LeBron is not going to pour cold water on all of it. There's going to be some way, some door cracked that a return to Cleveland could happen. I understand right now, and I'm hearing like a lot of the same things you probably are, LeBron. You know, that door is basically closed at this point. LeBron went to L.A., wants to stay in L.A., but that's one of those things. It's like the whole, like, when the reports out there that the Jazz were going to build around Donovan Mitchell. I didn't believe that, and sure as shit, that turned out not to all be true. I just don't, like, LeBron is not going to just go through the motions in L.A. for a few years. He's going to try to compete for a championship in the twilight of his career, and if Cleveland offers the best chance to do it, you just can't rule it out. You can't rule a return to Cleveland out.
100%. 100%. And I think it matters also, you know, Dan Gilbert, unfortunately, has had some health issues and I believe has had to step back. And classically, that's been the headbutt with LeBron, like him and Dan Gilbert sort of butting heads over the years. And now he's not quite as much in the picture. And I'm not saying I've heard anything, but, you know.
No, and you know what else? You know what's interesting,
there's
too, Kyle?
Subjects there.
You know what's interesting, too? Like, the Cavaliers are theoretically the small market team in this Lakers-Cavaliers discussion. The Cavaliers, when they had LeBron, spent like drunken sailors. Like, they spent and spent and spent, and they were not afraid of being a luxury tax team. The Lakers have made financial decisions over the last couple of years, from Alex Caruso to any discussion about what they're going to take back in a Westbrook deal. They have based some of their decision-making on finances, where I'm not so sure the Cavs really ever did that. Like, Dan Gilbert, for all his flaws and all his conflicts with LeBron, his camp, they know that team spends and will spend to win a championship. That may mean, like, bringing Kevin Love back after LeBron signs, bringing Caris LeVert back after LeBron signs. Like, I think that if you're looking about the team that'll spend the most to win, right now it's Cleveland. Like, that team, I think, will spend the money needed for LeBron James to win late in his career.
Yeah, and I mean, look, you know Cleveland surely better than I do. I just think the Lakers dynamic, yeah, it's a little tricky, and I think you're seeing certainly some pushback by front office and ownership on the impulses that LeBron would classically demand or have, like trade the whole team at the trade deadline, and they didn't do that, and they're sort of like, oh, you guys are Hall of Famers, figure it out, but. I think there probably needs to be a little bit of recognition from the front office and Genie that this guy is the best thing to happen to your franchise in 10 years. And there's a banner on the wall and he knows how to, or at least he has some understanding. And yes, he probably undermined his own case last year when he's like, we got to trade for Russ and that's gone how that's gone. But I mean, I think one thing you can count on LeBron for is like, he's like, what can we do to win a championship now? And he's never going to stop calculating that. He's never going to stop shooting for that. And to be honest, for the wilderness that the Lakers were in, that's a good mindset to have, because I think the franchise has been so used to, well, like every couple of years we reform, guys want to come here, but it's a different NBA right now where guys are increasingly getting under these long-term deals. Guys aren't hitting free agency the way they used to. Teams are reluctant to let guys walk for nothing, so they start trading them two or a year before their contract ends. And the Lakers don't have assets. So look at the star you got. Look at the stars you got. They already won a championship with LeBron and AD. Like, maybe they could do it again. I don't like their chances against the West, but like, maybe they could do it again. So like, why are you protecting these picks so hard, you know, 7 years in the future when you have two guys who have won a championship on your team now? So I think that sums up the case that LeBron would make for sort of his mentality. And I think probably for the Lakers to do anything, there has to be some alignment between the team and LeBron on that issue.
I don't think LeBron's wrong on that either. If you have a chance to win with Anthony Davis and LeBron James, two top 10-ish players in the NBA, you got to sell out and do it. If that means dealing more draft picks to be highly successful for the next 2 or 3 years, you do it and you figure out the rest later. Maybe you have to rebuild. Maybe get lucky in the draft with a late first or a second round pick, and who knows? But I think you've got to go all in when you've got those types of players. Kyle, you are all in this summer, my friend. No off season for you, which you know, it sucks in a way, but you cover the most interesting team in the league right now, and there's a lot of interest in reading about it and hearing about it, talking about it. So I guess job security is the upside to all that.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone's gonna trade me yet, so we'll see.
You can follow Kyle on Twitter at Kyle Goon, read his stuff in the Orange County Register and all the other papers in the Southern California newsroom. Kyle, see you soon, man.
Thanks, Chris.
And when we come back, my conversation with Jeremy Wu. All right, NBA Summer League is in the books. Always a couple weeks worth of overreacting on the results of NBA Summer League. So figured we'd join the fray on Summer League overreactions and much more. Jeremy Wu, the outstanding draft analyst over at SI.com, who, I mean, I can't believe it, Jeremy. You're already going to AAU tournaments this week. Are we already turning the page to the 2023 draft?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is really like long-term stuff. Like, these guys won't be in the draft for another few years, but that's kind of just how the schedule runs. I did not go to Pete Sham this year. I saved myself some of the hassle with that. But there's, you know, there's some stuff in the Midwest here that I feel like it's so close that I should at least like show up for a day. So, you know, next couple of days I'll be scouting a little bit.
You know, you say these AAU guys won't be in the draft, but it seems like we talk about it a lot, but we got to be closing in soon on the day high schoolers return to the draft. I mean, Adam Silver, once again, over the last couple of weeks, I believe, you know, professed his interest in or desire to have it drop back down to 18. I mean, the people you talk to, are they expecting that sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the line that I've heard the most from people, and it's just that, like, whatever happens, it won't be until, you know, the next CBA agreement. So it's going to have to be, I think, collectively bargained in. I think, you know, obviously, even, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, we all thought this was going to happen. And it turned out that it was just like less of a big deal than I think people expected. You know, I think, you know, Silver and the NBA, you know, had an opportunity to push for it. But I think, you know, there was a realization that, like, you know, none of the teams are that excited about having a, you know, draft younger players. And, you know, the Players Association wasn't super, I don't think, concerned or excited about, you know, when you introduce these guys, it takes away jobs for more people, right? Mm. So, like, you know, there's that element of it. So I just think nobody was in a hurry. So we'll see, you know, to what extent it gets used as a, you know, negotiating point in the next CBA. But, you know, I've heard nothing new really on that front. I haven't been asking about it because it's just been such sort of not a big deal, at least in the last, you know, year or so.
Yeah, I can echo what you're saying about executives and draft analysts not being all that enthused about high schoolers coming back in, because it's hard enough to assess the NBA potential of a player who plays anywhere from 15 to 30 college games, you know, much less someone that's dominating in high school. I mean, I don't know why this popped in my mind, but I was watching some video on Twitter of Zion Williamson in high school. Like, it was like the equivalent of Adam Sandler in Billy Madison. Just like, he's just dominating and dunking on guys. And like, you know, Zion's obviously a special talent, but you know, you need to have something to compare it to. And at least that 1 year of college is oftentimes something to compare it to. So we'll see what happens with that. But that's something I think that's coming at some point into the NBA draft. All right, let's talk about the guys that were at Summer League. Let's kind of focus at the top on the top three picks, because these three guys, Paolo Banchero, Chet Holmgren, and Jabari Smith, they are going to be intertwined for a long time. On draft night, it seemed like Jabari Smith was going to be the pick. Then all of a sudden, you know, the reporting trickles in where the Magic have decided to go with Paolo. Chet Holmgren, he was locked in at number two. Oklahoma City was really high on him. And look, I've talked to a couple of executives subsequently that said if they had the number one pick, they would have taken Chet with that number one pick. So Oklahoma City really believes in his potential. Then you have Jabari Smith, really young. I mean, I think he just turned 19 very recently, but showed, at least to my eyes, a lot of two-way tools at Summer League. You know, perimeter shooting, defense. He's really long, great potential there. Give me your takeaways on what you saw from the top three guys at the various Summer Leagues.
Yeah. Well, look, I think clearly those guys, you know, all three of them are really good players. And I think that, you know, there was some discussion about, like, is this a good draft or not? And I always hate that discussion because it's kind of pointless. But were there three really good players at the top? Yeah. I think that, you know, that much was validated where even for me, like, look, we've talked about this before. I had Jabari Smith one. I still think he's going to end up being the best player of the three. But after seeing Summer League and seeing everything kind of manifest, it's like, yeah, I can understand. Not that I didn't before, but it's even clearer to me that, you know, you can argue it, you know, any which way with those three guys. So it kind of comes down to a matter of taste and kind of like foresight. But I thought, you know, all three of them had their moments. I mean, you know, we can start with Paolo. You know, he looked really comfortable getting to his jumper. You know, he's still not creating a ton of really, really easy shots for himself. But like, I think clearly the, you know, the skill level and his size, you know, he's really, really big. Like, people don't quite understand how uncommon it is. Like, it's funny. I was kind of thinking about him in the vein of like, obviously not a direct equivalence here, but like, you know, DeMarcus Cousins as a guy who was like super big and super skilled and super productive. You know, Paolo is more of a perimeter player, you know, so he's different. He's a more, I guess, modern big in that way. But like, you know, maybe some similarities in that respect in terms of like how you can use a guy like that. You know, if he's a more, I mean, that's a pretty good, interesting player. And I think if you look at, you know, Orlando's roster, you know, they needed someone to kind of be that connector to kind of, you know, they have a lot of pieces that, you know, players who have, you know, interesting individual potential, but they, I think, you know, the next step for Orlando is sort of like letting that roster coalesce into, you know, try to see what the vision is going to be. Like, what does it look like together? Who's going to move the ball around? And so I think Paolo, you know, being able to, you know, bring the ball up a little bit, distribute, kind of fits that criteria. So like, it's funny because
he's a willing and a good passer. Like, his physique immediately jumps out. He is light years ahead of Jabari Smith physically, much less Chet Holmgren. So he's physically ready to play minutes in the NBA. But when I watched him, and I agree, like, you know, wasn't terrific. He had a lot of isolation opportunities. Didn't really show much in my eyes in those opportunities. But he plays with his head up. He looks for his teammates, and he's a good passer. He's going to collect, I think, a lot of assists on that Magic team if he plays that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, I was, you know, surprised when they took him, but, you know, Paolo was still number two on my board. So it wasn't like I could like bash the pick. Like, you know, that's not how I generally operate either. You can understand the methodology there. And, but I think it's going to take a little bit of time for this to bear out, obviously. And, you know, maybe more so than, in some other years too. Like I would just be cautious to not like leap to conclusions here. I mean, you know, we can talk about Chet a little bit. I mean, he,
let me set that up. You know, I've written a little bit about Chet. I saw him play in Salt Lake City a couple of games. I saw him play in Las Vegas. And my opinion on Chet has remained the same over the last couple of weeks. If you're high on him, you saw what you needed to. You saw the skills. You saw the shooting. You saw the ball handling. You saw a player that can be a star in the NBA. If you're not high on him, you saw those things too. You saw the physique. And you wonder just how big and how strong is he going to be and how much of a problem is that going to be at the NBA level. So what did you see in Chet?
Yeah, I don't think anything – I guess if there was one thing that really was a pleasant surprise for me – and, like, look, I don't get surprised that often by Summer League just because I watch, like, way too much of these guys. So if something is actually going to surprise me at Summer League, it's actually, you know, something different. You normally – I don't go out of my way to say this, but, like, he – his shooting was definitely looked improved, you know, from distance. I still you know, think he's going to have to be really, really consistent. I think the floor spacing component is going to be a huge part of his value on offense, just because I'm still not convinced that the, you know, off the dribble stuff is going to really matter that much. Cause like, he's not really beating guys one-on-one in space. You know, it's everything's going to be, you know, getting back to that shot. Right. So whether it's, you know, just being able to hit a mid range, which he's shown he can, you know, flash, or, you know, just hitting enough threes to be a real threat. I mean, that's going to be a really big thing for him because he's a great, great finisher, very efficient, but just like, there are still moments where he can't, like in chaos scrum situations where the ball is kind of, you know, loose and people are going to get it. He's just, because of the way his body is, he's not super heavy or strong. He's just not going to win those battles with guys in the NBA. It just is what it is. I don't think it's even necessarily a critique. I just think it's something we need to accept. We don't need to nitpick. Is he too skinny? Because he's not. It's just a limitation that he has, right? So the good thing is defensively, like everything kind of came to fruition already. And I think, you know, it's pretty clear he's going to be a really good defender. When he has space to come pursue the ball and is not hit, you know, he's going to block the shot. He has great instincts. You can't really post him. It's not easy to post him just because he's very good at just staying vertical. So guys can't like go over the top of him. You know, you have to move him and then get into his body. And so now we'll see, you know, when the scout is more out on him and people have more of a plan, like Summer League is not necessarily like the level of basketball where people do the most planning. And these are the guys who are not as experienced. Right. So like, it's why it's hard to have takeaways. But I was overall like enthusiastic about, you know, Chet being able to be a net positive as a rookie. But for me, it was always more about, you know, where's he going to get to on offense? And I'm still not 100% sure how I feel about it, but, the defense certainly there, definitely, the upside certainly there.
Yeah. My default when I go back and forth on Chet is to lean towards Sam Presti knows what he's doing. He tends to do well with these types of guys, the questionable types of guys, whether it's Russell Westbrook or James Harden, drafted Serge Ibaka late. That hasn't been perfect, but yeah, he was pretty locked in on Chet for most of the last month or so, certainly since they got that second overall pick. And I'll choose for the moment to defer to Sam Presti on that one. The other guy in that mix, Jabari Smith, like I said, you know, great physical tools. You know, the games I saw wasn't overly assertive. Maybe that's something he's going to have to work on as he gets in the NBA, but I saw him make three-point shots. I saw him defend really well. He's got that great length. What does Houston have in him? How do you think he fits in with the Rockets?
Yeah, I'm not worried about Jabari really at all. Like, and I'm not just saying this to like double down on my previous opinion before the draft. Like, I firmly think that he, you know, is the guy that I'd want just like in a vacuum. Obviously, nothing happens in a vacuum. And so the situation in Houston is going to be, you know, we'll see how much that kind of bears out for him in terms of guys are going to have to get him the ball. But like, I would caution, you're not the first person who I've heard say this, but I would caution to not like, you know, conflate the, just the fact that he needs to be set up with him not being assertive. Right. Like I think, in terms of mentality, and focus and just never taking plays off. I mean, you know, he's as good as anybody, maybe the best, in my opinion, you know, arguably some of the best, if not the best, just like mental makeup in this draft, particularly when you consider how young he is. I mean, you know, one of the youngest players in all summer league, an entire year younger than Chet. So I think you just have to, this is something that's going to take time to bear out. You know, if he made more jumpers, I don't think the things that people are saying about him would be said. Right. And I think some of it's just, he's got to develop lower body strength, core strength. Going to have to, you know, develop, get more confident. Not that he lacks for it, but just there's an adjustment to the level and the speed of the game. But I think that's going to come for him. Now, I also think it's a myth that he needs to have a guard-like handle to be really good. I mean, this guy, he's not a guard. He doesn't have to be. Like, I think sometimes we conflate the idea of, like, shot creating, which is, you know, a term we throw around a lot. But, like, there are a lot of different ways to create shots, and it kind of depends on, you know, who your teammates are, who your coach is, and how they scheme those shots for you, right? So, like, if anything, I'm just encouraged by, you know, I thought Jabari's passing looked really good in transition. Like, I love that he makes the right play all the time. He's not like hunting these shots. You know, he doesn't break the offense to like take them. He's not selfish at all. And honestly, you could argue he was, you know, the best defender at all of summer league in terms of, you know, Houston really likes to switch everything. And if you're really watching him communicate and call out switches and like, you know, he'll see a mismatch and like, you know, if a guard gets switched onto a big, he'll talk and eliminate that switch and he'll just do that. You know, he was doing that in the flow of the game already in summer league. I mean, for someone that young, it's really impressive. So I'm overall just encouraged by how far ahead he is in other areas that maybe I wasn't even expecting. And I think he's obviously going to shoot. So I think the shot looked maybe a little bit flatter than in college, but I think it's just NBA range, lower body strength, age. Got to think about all this stuff. Like, he's never, ever been old for his level. So to kind of wrap this up, like the point that I've made, to a lot of people is, you know, think about the Ben Simmons, Brandon Ingram draft where it was like, it was easy to take Ben one because you could see all the stuff he could do. You know, Paolo, kind of the same thing, right? You further along physically, you can see what he can do. It's very, very obvious. You can watch 10 minutes and be like, okay. You know, but with Brandon, it was like, you're betting on, you know, the skill, the size, the shooting and like developmental intangibles. And, you know, I think you could, it's pretty clear right now, like trade value wise, you know, Brandon is the more valuable player than Ben. So, not to say that's going to happen, but I just think I just use that as a point of caution where we shouldn't jump to conclusions about who the number one pick should be, you know, 2 months later. Right. I mean, we got to give this a few years.
So I sat down on the opening night of Summer League to watch Orlando against Houston, Paolo against Jabari. And I found myself watching Caleb Houston with the Magic. I didn't know anything about him coming into this draft, but I see the plays he was making, the shots he was making, the way he looked just so comfortable out there on the floor, spacing well, just looked like an NBA player to me out there. And I start kind of asking around and, you know, I hear about the uneven year at Michigan, you know, just all the things that prevented him from being a first round pick. I liked him a lot, Jeremy. And I know it's summer league and he's got to prove it at NBA level, but that's someone that looked to me like someone like a player with NBA tools.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, you know, Houston is one of those guys who had the pedigree coming in. You know, I was one of many people who projected him as top 10, you know, lottery level player. That didn't come to fruition. It's okay. Like, you know, we kind of screwed that up, but doesn't mean he's not going to have a good NBA career. I think it was evident to me, too, as someone who, you know, has watched him since he was, you know, 15, 16 at Montverde Academy. You kind of, well, A, he looks like he put on a little bit of muscle, which is good. B, you know, his shot, the release is so quick. It was good to see him shooting with confidence. He doesn't dip the ball. He catches it. He shoots it. It's a good fit with Paolo, good fit with Orlando. Kind of, they need, you know, they're going to need floor spacing to kind of maximize him as their guy. He's got the size, right? So those are three things that I think immediately played. You know, he relocates really well off the ball, you know, something you've mentioned to me. And yeah, I mean, this is a guy who knows how to play with other good players. Like, he, you know, played at Montverde where he was the fifth best player on a team with like six NBA players, right? So like, you're not going to have to teach him how to be a role player. Now, why did he fall in the draft? I think it kind of goes back to, I think this is a good, you know, point to moving forward. It's really hard to play as a freshman in the Big Ten, particularly as someone who, you know, watches a lot of Big Ten basketball for better or worse. Like, I try to do a lot of Big Ten games and it's physical, it's tough. These coaches are really good defensive coaches. I also think it's a little bit more evident now, but Michigan's guard play was not very good this year. So I think, you know, even having a really big shooter like that, it's sometimes hard to maximize those guys if you don't have guards who really know how to set them up. It just kind of was, you know, situationally how they played hurt him a little bit too. But, you know, there were also moments where he didn't look very tough defensively, didn't look like he could really create his own shot at all. Wasn't the player I think that we, you know, we were being sold coming out of high school. Right. And there's sometimes I think naturally there's a tendency to kind of like, when it doesn't add up, you push back on it too far in the other direction. And maybe that's kind of what happened with Caleb. But you know, to that point is it is interesting when you look at the guys who kind of went, you know, 27 to, you know, he went 32 in the draft. If you look at you know, players in that range, you know, Patrick Baldwin Jr., Nikola Jovic, Peyton Watson. You know, these are guys who, you know, were projected lottery picks at one point. Stock slipped a little bit, but, you know, the good teams, well, just teams in general, they don't forget about that, right? The pedigree still matters. And I think, you know, all those guys, well, Baldwin didn't play, but, you know, those guys all had moments. Peyton Watson had a nice summer league. So it kind of just goes back to that point where we have to keep those pedigree guys in mind and not let the needle move too far, maybe.
All right. We didn't even get through the draft, or maybe we just barely got through the draft when the jockeying for 2023 had already begun. You had San Antonio move DeJounte Murray effectively for draft picks. You had Indiana move Malcolm Brogdon effectively for a draft pick, although they did go out and try to sign DeAndre Ayton. You got to give him credit for that. But, you know, we're already kind of gearing up for the 2023 draft. And the prize in that draft is clearly Victor Wembanyama. Hope I'm saying that right. Everywhere I go, I hear about how good this kid is. Executives talking about how surefire number one. I hear Giannis comparisons. Tell me how good Victor Wembanyama is. And is he worth all this tanking that seems to be going on to get him?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, I say this having not yet seen him in person. You know, I'm going to make sure I go to France this year. Boo-hoo, I have to go to France. but I definitely will, you know, make a point of going to see him during the season. You know, at this point, I've probably watched, I guess, I don't know, I probably watched like between 7 and 10 games on tape over the years, you know, between, you know, FIBA international stuff and then his pro team and, you know, getting more familiar with him. And look, like, some of the stuff he does, particularly defensively, is just like, you know, mind-blowing. I mean, the amount of area he covers, you know, at, I think he's listed 7'3". I don't know off the top of my head what the wingspan is, but it's probably going to look stupid. He just, you know, he covers so much ground. His instincts are so good, both retreating in pursuit and also getting out onto shooters. So like, you know, it's funny. I was actually watching on the plane, you know, to Vegas, I was watching some of his film, and it's like, well, you know, thinking about watching Chet dominate defensively at Summer League, well, this is a guy who's, you know, a more impactful defender than him around the basket. So like, you know, just think about that as a baseline for what the defense is going to be, right? I mean, he's bigger, he's stronger, longer. Like it's nuts. Like this is like game breaking defensive stuff. And offensively, look, like he definitely is somebody who can make shots and I think projects to be a above average jump shooter. Too early to say, you know, how dynamic and in what way. And I'm still getting familiar with that. And I think, again, this is also somebody who is playing against guys who are older than him, you know, in France. So when we're talking about what's his offensive game going to be, like, I don't want to put limits on it. I'm still personally kind of getting a feel for like what it's going to be. But like, you know, for all intents and purposes, this looks like a guy who is a, you know, clearly a franchise centerpiece, you know, should be able to be like a 1A on a contending team. If you just factor in the defensive impact and what the offensive upside is, you know, still early. And again, I'm always careful to not throw too many hyperbolic statements with guys who I haven't seen play live just because I want to be patient. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, this is one of the best prospects, definitely in my time doing this, maybe the best that I don't want to say scouted because I haven't gone to see him yet, but that I've seen. So it's going to be, I think, hard to keep the lid on the hype just because it's going to come and people are going to see it and, you know, knock on wood, he stays healthy and, you know, goes rail to rail at number one, which, you know, if he is healthy, I personally like, you know, Scoot Henderson is really good, but I personally don't see anybody else really giving Victor a run for it just based on my understanding of this next year's class right now.
Everybody's talking about him. Everybody wants a piece of him. Be very interested to see how he plays this year. And, just who lands that number one pick next spring. Jeremy, good stuff, man. Enjoy the AAU circuit for now, and look forward to that very first mock draft board sometime in the fall.
Absolutely. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.